Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Have you ever wished that you had a direct line to your pediatrician to ask all the questions that constantly crop up while parenting? We sure have. That's why we launched the Bites of Health podcast. Every morning, we'll answer a commonly asked pediatric question in 5 minutes or less. You can tune in while you're making your second cup of coffee or from the school drop-off line. So be sure to tune in to Bites of Health, streaming now.
Hello, welcome to Emotional Badass, where Moxie meets Mindful. I'm your host, Nikki Eisenhower, life coach and psychotherapist. And on today's episode, I'm discussing post-traumatic stress and early childhood experiences. I want to discuss post-traumatic stress and get to some early childhood experiences that contributed to the severe PTSD symptoms I had for most of my life. And thank goodness I no longer have most of those symptoms, though I sometimes have what I would call some remnants or some shadows. It's like I'm in remission from post-traumatic stress, and that means I need to know that it's my job to prioritize my health so that I don't have resurgences, recurrences. And depending on life, that's going to be easier or harder. Depending on what life throws at me, it's going to be more or less within my power. I don't think there's ever a time in our lives where we have any kind of guarantee that life won't throw us some kind of stressor, something from left field, something we didn't intend, something we didn't want, and something that's hard. But I've got to work within the reality of doing what I can do and letting go of the rest as a big part of exactly how I take care of myself. At the end of this episode, I'm going to share a few quotes from my emotional strength training 30 Days to Peace, some comments from participants. I want you to know that the next group goes through the course starting on the first of the month. And as I share in today's episode, I hope that it informs you about why I'm passionate about teaching peace and why I think that peace as a practice is what is largely missing in traditional mental health landscapes. So here's a little background to the psychology of early childhood experiences. It was a common assumption for a very long time in our human history to assume that it didn't have much of an impact on future life. And I think this is an assumption that was made out of a comfort over a reality. Now, it's been a comforting thought, I think, for adults to believe that kids just forget. They just don't remember, and therefore they're unaffected by whatever they go through in their early life. Isn't that a very comfortable and convenient idea? Wouldn't that be nice if that were true? I grew up hearing this phrase a lot. I don't hear it so much anymore, but kids are resilient. And I think in times past, when this phrase was used, kids are resilient, it was a real dismissal of that early life, that early childhood experience. Now, I'm a big believer that kids are most definitely resilient. And, not or, and they are most definitely impacted by what happens to them during this most precious time of our early development, when our brains, our personalities, our nervous system, and our attachment styles are in development. We're very complicated creatures, and our early life is part of the foundation of who we become. From numerous studies evolving over the last 70 or more years, we now believe very differently. We very much know, believe, and operate from the idea that early childhood definitely has an impact. Harry Harlow, ran the very famous rhesus monkey studies in the 50s. And you don't have to have a psychology or a counseling degree like I do to know of these studies. You might recall these images as I talk about them. These images, for me, are just one of those things that are burned into my mind. Like, I will have these images with me forever. It's that little monkey screaming and looking completely distressed and forlorn in a cage, clinging to a simple little towel wrapped around a wire form that was sort of like the form of a figure, the form of a monkey. And that monkey was clinging to that towel in the absence of its mother, in the absence of another monkey, in the absence of a surrogate. Because monkeys, humans, were primates. And we know that primates, we need, and I mean need, socialization. We need safe, consistent warmth. We need warmth physically. We need warmth emotionally from our caretakers, our caregivers. We need connection and protection because we're mostly helpless. You know, we've all seen videos of horses and cows and deer being born, giraffes, everything. And they come out standing up, moving around, being able to grab some grass off of the ground. Not humans. We come out exceptionally helpless for years after we come into the world. So attachment to our primary caregivers, our lives depend on it. That's not an exaggeration. That's not me being dramatic. Our lives depend on our attachment to our caretakers. When we are attached appropriately, when there is enough safety, enough comfort, enough warmth, enough security, enough protection, enough food, our needs are met. We develop this sense of security. And this helps us forge ahead in our lives. It is innately human, y'all. Not just explorers that back in our history explored the earth, discovered new lands. It is innately human to all of us, every single one of us that are born. Not that we're going to discover a new island or a new continent or a new area, but we're going to go out into the world and discover our own lives. We're going to explore. We're going to create our lives. We're going to step into so many unknowns, and living a life, a good life, it takes a certain amount of risk, and it takes risking again and again and again, not recklessly risking, but intelligent, calculated, strategic, maybe even intuitive, risking again and again and again and again. We are required to lean into different unknowns until they become known. This is the human condition. Adulthood. We don't know what we're doing as adults till we get there and experience it. I can say the same about motherhood, the same about marriage, a new job, a new career, a new home in a new area, a new town, a new city. We are faced with risking to make adult friends. We will risk all the days of our life in the pursuit of a good life, however we individually define that good life for ourselves. People who have disrupted, dysfunctional, neglectful, or abandoning, or simply careless, low empathy caregivers, caretakers, we have our security, the development of that security, disrupted and damaged. And this can impede our ability to assess daily life from a place of security. We are required to lean into healthy risk. So if we were raised through insecurity, that's going to be our lens for each and every risk that we face taking to build our lives. Through insecurity, everything looks dangerous. Everything looks dark, dooming, looming. And this is very depressing over time. Now, it's useful to be in survival mode when we are surviving. If I am an active duty soldier, survival mode is right on the money. It's useful. Survival mode, I can argue is even useful if I'm still in an abusive environment or relationship. Survival mode keeps me on guard. But survival mode is not living mode. And this is depressing over years and years and years. If I am in survival mode constantly, what even is life? What is the point? This is an easy line of thinking from the exhaustion of post-traumatic stress. And it makes suicidal thoughts easy to access, which then, unfortunately, makes suicidal actions easier to access too. I want you to be able to understand your relationship to your early life. Not to dwell on it, not to play victim mode, not to be overly dramatic about hardship, but to truly and deeply understand towards being able to take care of yourself. To understand post-traumatic stress in yourself or someone you love is to offer a lifeline. It's to offer a grounding force. I could never explain the complexity of post-traumatic stress in one or even 10, maybe even in 100 episodes. But I can simply and directly tell you that if you suffer with a constant survival mode, at the level of your brain's experience, I'm not talking about people who go, oh, today was tough, I have PTSD. I'm talking about a true neurochemical experience of your brain, of your body, that reacts to trauma in a way that is outside of your conscious control. That is post-traumatic stress. If you have suffered with a constant survival mode, an all too present, all too familiar survival mode without enough life mode, it is your job to rewire your brain. This is the struggle in us being creatures that learn. We learn so well. Like my little self learned so well to be in a constant state of survival. If we have post-traumatic stress, it is our job. I will die on this hill, y'all. It is our job to teach ourselves to shift out of survival mode and into thriving mode. And yes, that's scary. It's confusing to figure out what that is, how to do that. The language used around post-traumatic stress is that our brains get hijacked. That feels incredibly unfair. Very easy to slip into the victim mentality of feeling powerless against your own brain, feeling a fight within your own self. It's very confusing. It's very overwhelming. It is almost common knowledge at this point for us to know that our brains can change. Our brains are malleable. We use the word plastic, neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity means that we can rewire. We can change our brains. It is your job if you struggle with this group of symptoms from a lot of hardship, from a lot of trauma, to reteach yourself that life is about more than surviving. Do you see how a lot had to go wrong if a human being learns that all life is surviving? That means you've had a tough life. And that's not a death sentence. That's not all there is. You are not doomed to that forever. And to think so and to believe so is wrong. If you have survived a lot, then let's get our energies moving forward to building a life where you can thrive, where you can be safe, where you are safe. And never, ever, ever, I don't care how you feel, this is the goal. It's the goal to come back to on a good day. My job is to teach myself to thrive and to find and secure safety. Even when that feels slow, even when that feels out of reach, even when other people give me excuses that I should just give up because life is too hard. No, never is this not the goal. Your goal is to shift to thriving, to learn what it is, all the nuance, and to provide that for yourself, no matter what, no excuses. What I have to say to suicidal ideation that grows for someone who has post-traumatic stress is stop wasting your precious energy on these BS thoughts. Your only job right now is to build a safe life you can live in, and suicidal thoughts are not helpful and are a waste of that time and your precious energy. Your body doesn't need to feel thoughts that tell you that your life is not worth living. That's not fair. That's not healthy. That's not the right escape route. You deserve and are worthy of finding your escape route. It's not ever, ever, ever death, ever. Say no to your suicidal ideation. And that's not me dismissing it. That's not me telling you to not talk about it with your therapist. Definitely talk about it with your therapist. When we say it out loud, it loses steam. It builds up a secret power and steam when we don't acknowledge that these thoughts are creeping in. We want to acknowledge and release. We don't want to give these destructive thoughts power. We don't want them to build momentum. We don't want them to build this secret steam. Suicidal ideation, it's like a sneaky demon, and we do not invite possession. I was raised Catholic, so that hits me harder. If there's a better idea that can help you shut down suicidal ideation, resist it. Turn away from it. Every day, every moment, your task is to give yourself permission to shift out of survival and into thriving. Have I said it enough yet? I promise you, just like riding a bike, just like driving a car, just like getting better at maybe cooking a chicken when maybe that used to be out of your wheelhouse, the more you practice thriving, just like the more you practice anything, the better you will get at it, the easier it will get. As you shift away from so much survival and practice and get a muscle memory in thriving, thriving can become more of your natural state. It is honestly and genuinely my natural state now. And that is something that if we could go back in time and ask 25-year-old me, I wouldn't have believed it was possible. I don't care how intelligently your hypervigilance wants to argue with me on this. Because hypervigilance only wants to be on guard. And it wants to be on guard constantly. Because if we learned this response in childhood especially, it's like a little kid logic. It's as if some part of us goes, okay, a lot of bad things happen. I figured out how to take care of myself. I'll just be on guard constantly. I will always have armor on. I will always have a shield, and I will always have a sword. And the thinking sort of stops there from our immaturity. And it doesn't think beyond it unless you engage a therapeutic practice, unless you engage mindfulness, unless you directly guide yourself towards changing how you think and how you move through the world. To let go of what trauma teaches, not operate as if the trauma messaging is some kind of wisdom. Hypervigilance only knows how to be on guard, and it believes that it is the smartest way you could take care of yourself. But to be constantly scared and on guard about whatever, we all have different fears, right? And to each of us, those fears feel very, very important and very, very valid. But to be constantly scared about whatever, money, politics, predators, an illness, that there might be a leak in the roof, this is not the smartest way to live. This is only the way to continue surviving. This is not the best way to take care of ourselves, to keep giving the car of our life, the driver's seat of our life, to hypervigilance. Now, I mean it with so much love and so much care. I've had to say it to myself over the years. I don't care how strongly your hypervigilance wants to argue with this logic. It's just not right for you to stay in survival mode any longer than necessary. Hypervigilance can only be hypervigilant. It doesn't possess the insight to think any differently. It cannot be the decider of our lives. I know that your wisest parts, your wise man or your wise woman, not the eye-rolling inner adolescent part that wants to turn me off, flip me the bird, shut me up, turn the channel. Your wisest part, the part that you were growing and nurturing, or you wouldn't be here listening to this podcast, is the deep down truth. Your wisest parts, they know and they resonate with what I'm saying. I know it to be true, like the sky is blue. That part hears me. That part quiets down because that wise part is your most mature. It knows how to get past all the immaturity inside of us that struggles to hold on to what's familiar, even when what's familiar is exhausting us and draining our life force. That wise part won't argue me on this. It might not know how to shift into thriving, but it certainly won't argue with me that hypervigilance is the way to go for all the days, all the minutes of our lives. If you have had a hard life with a whole lot of survival, it is only right. Now, typically I speak in the middle ground, right? Between the black or white, all or nothing thinking, into the gray, and there's so many shades of gray, right? This is a time where I will just go black or white, all or nothing, hard line. If you've had a lot of survival, it is only right that you get to learn what peace and calm and ease and love, trust, satisfaction, contentment, lightness, laughter, awe at what is beautiful, like a sunset or a baby smiling. You get to know joy, damn it. You get to know living over surviving. I want that for you in this one precious life. And I hope you will let yourself emotionally risk enough to allow yourself to think that, to believe it, to say it, to write it down. You are worthy of thriving. You really are. It's time.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds, like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
I want to briefly share with you some early childhood experiences of mine that very much shaped my nervous system and personality development. I hope it gets you thinking about what has shaped you. And I hope it brings you to compassion for yourself or for others. I see so many people who are so hard on themselves, so self-shaming and utterly confused about why they feel so much tension or guardedness or lack of joy for life. And this creates an anxiety and then a depression. And they're so hard on themselves. A lot of people show up to me now going, Nikki, I get it. I get why you had anxiety. I get why you had depression. I get why you had PTSD. But that stuff didn't happen to me. Like, what is wrong with me? And often we look back at early childhood and we can see it. We can see what happened there. And it doesn't have to happen because somebody was mean or cruel or sadistic. Sometimes it's just the way life shakes out. We don't have to look for fault when we're looking for understanding. When we look at early childhood, we can get some answers about who we are today, and it can guide us to find what we truly need, to balance, to adjust, to calibrate who we are and what we can do for ourselves now, based on that early childhood. Now, when it comes to trauma, other than the way that it is completely overused and watered down, lots of people are using that word that if they saw me, I would say, sorry, you were not traumatized, or good news, you were not traumatized, depending on where your head's at with that. But one of the things to consider is that things that happened to us when we were very little might very well be traumatizing to a little being, but would most certainly not be traumatizing today as an adult. So I want you to consider these examples through the lens of a tender, fairly helpless child. While we might feel helpless as adults, the adult truth and reality is we are not, and it is our job to figure out how to empower ourselves, how to be helpful to ourselves, not helpless within to ourselves. A small child has no worldview, no perspective. Our homes and our family system is the entire world. It might as well be the entire planet. So it's very hard to think outside of ourselves, impossible, until we hit certain developmental ages and stages. It's also true that small children, particularly babies, do not possess an ability to self-regulate their bodies, their nervous systems. A baby's system mostly regulates by feeling the adult that they are bonded with and regulating as that adult is regulating. This is a very important consideration, particularly if we had parents that had no idea how to regulate themselves. That gives us a big clue as to why we might feel what we feel in our bodies today. When I was born, I was a month early. And that was 4.5 decades ago now. And that made me a super preemie. Now, today we have different advancements, different technologies. Now babies can and do survive as early as 23 to 24 weeks. But that was unheard of when I was born. Now, I've mentioned that I was raised Catholic. I was born into a Catholic family. So the priest was brought in and I was given an emergency baptism. And then immediately following the death sacrament, Catholics call it last rites. In every bad Catholic movie you've ever seen, the priest comes in to give those last rites before someone dies. This is to repent. This is to clear the soul of any sinning to be able to get into heaven. Now, you can have whatever feelings you have about that being done to a very innocent baby. That's a separate conversation. This is what I was born into. What an experience in the first hours of my life, huh? But then, me being born with something I have come to call my beautiful stubbornness. I know a lot of you out there listening also possess the stubbornness that maybe no one has ever told you, when put in the right place, can be quite beautiful. Quite a boon to this life to be stubborn in the right places. Not so great when we're stubborn in the wrong places. But my stubborn self just wouldn't die. My lungs were underdeveloped, and I was in an incubator for about a month. But in knowing that I was having trouble breathing, my very lungs were not fully formed when I was born. Think about what that feels like to not be able to breathe. If any of us cannot breathe very, very quickly, we are panicking, right? There's no organism who breathes with lungs on this planet that if they can't breathe, doesn't have panic. I can't know for sure, but it's a pretty good bet that my little body was feeling a lot of panic. And panic is not just an emotion. When we are scared for our life, our bodies release all kinds of chemicals to help us fight for our lives. But me and therapists I've worked with, even professors that I've shared my story with when I was in school, have speculated that I was likely already in a survival mode, right upon being born. One of the stories, the lore of my life, and we all have lore, is that my mom, pregnant in high school with me, had a best friend who delivered a baby 3 months before I was born. And before I was born, right before I was born, that baby died of SIDS. That baby died of sudden infant death syndrome. And I was a preemie and almost died, and so did my two younger sisters. My mom is a lifelong, very heavy smoker. You have never seen someone smoke a cigarette in one puff like my mother can. It's both impressive and gross to me all at the same time. She would swear up and down she didn't smoke when she was pregnant with any of us, that she stopped the moment she found out. But all three of her children had every symptom of a smoking mother. So when we went home from the hospital, we were all on heart and oxygen monitors because my mom insisted after her friend's baby died. And I, of course, don't have memories of my mom running to me when my heart would stop, when my lungs would stop, and resuscitating me. But I was 3 when my second sister was born. And my room was directly across from the baby's room. My parents was on the other side of the house, and my mom had a baby monitor. This was big for parents in the 80s. And my mom would run. She would haul ass. She would go quickly when the baby monitor would go off. But I would get in the room first. And I knew it wasn't shielded from me. I knew that those machines going off meant that my sisters were not breathing or their heart had stopped and that they could die. This happened multiple times a week. And they wore the monitors over a year, both of them. And I have memories of my mom slapping the babies on the back, turning them over, rubbing her knuckles on their sternums to simulate the heartbeat. And I was just standing there watching at 3 and then at 5. I have no idea how many times I saw my mother resuscitate my sisters. Every single time I was aware that they could die. And I can give my mom credit here. I've talked a lot on the show about believing my mother to be a sociopath, and every sociopath is a narcissist. My mom did a lot right, but it was very robotic. My mom isn't a sadist, in my opinion, but the mothering she did was very connectionless. She has almost no warmth, no ability to connect to people. Like the empathy center was damaged in her early life. Or she was simply born without that empathy center. She could go through the motions of doing the right thing some of the time, like reviving her children, which must have been very taxing, very exhausting, very hard on her, in all fairness. And my biological father was not a peach. I've had to understand that I was going through terror at 3 and 5 years old. And the person that was there to comfort me through what was terrifying just didn't have the stuff, that very stuff that we can't take out of a body and measure. We can't put it in a beaker and tell you how many milliliters someone has of empathy. It's part of why I think of mental health as more of an art form, or at least equally an art form as much as it is a science. I don't believe all of it can be evidence-based the way that we seem to want in this modern life and in my very profession. Things that are not evidence-based are poo-pooed. They're dismissed as dirty, stinking opinion and valueless. But we can't measure things like empathy. We can't measure the effects. How much was I affected? There's no measurement for that. My mom didn't possess the very stuff that would have and could have really soothed me, helped me not feel so traumatized, to buffer what is difficult about this life. And we very much get our first tastes of buffering, of protection, of ideas about the world in those early years of our life. We learn if the world is harsh to us or kind. This experience means that I often woke up very unnaturally in the middle of the night, sometimes multiple times a night. We now know that insufficient sleep very much impacts the gray matter development of a young brain. When I was almost 6, my mother became very, very depressed. She was suicidal and was admitted to a psych unit for a few weeks. I have one memory of visiting her there with my grandmother. Who knows what energies I was around and in while she was in that state, while my father was at work, while my sisters were very little, and I was the eldest. By the time I was 7, my parents had separated. My biological father had begun his role as a deadbeat dad when he had formerly been in my daily life till then. I began having sleep terrors. And this is what made my mom get me my first therapist at 6 years old. Now, sleep terrors are like bad dreams on steroids. It's not like waking up going, oh my gosh, what a bad dream, and then recounting the dream. So glad I'm awake now. I'd wake up in full fight or flight, screaming like I was being murdered. Must have been hard for everyone in the house. And I was inconsolable. At this point in my 40s, it really is genuinely almost laughably tragic to me that I would need so much soothing and be born to a mother who just didn't have it in her to actually soothe, which made me more raw. More needing of safety, more needing of comfort, the less I got it. What a combination of mother and daughter for both of us. During my parents' separation, I was warned that my father, fluent in Italian, wished to kidnap us, take us away from our mother and grandparents, and leave us for dead in Italy. The school was involved. We were under constant kidnapping threat. And it was my job to protect my siblings. I was told that directly. And I'd be told this one day, and then the next day, if my mom was too tired, she'd then tell me to walk me and my sisters to school. Those early years for me, from 6 to 9, when that kidnapping threat was happening, I lived very torn, very confused, very terrified, consistently. I both yearned for my father. He was warmer than my mom. And I was terrified by that storyline that to this day, I don't know if that was actually true. I don't know if that was said in anger and my mom used it during the divorce. I just don't know. The child molester in my life didn't come into my life till I was 9 years old. And it took him a few years to groom me, while my younger siblings were easier to groom and were abused before he tried to abuse me. So in hearing this part of my story before 9 years old, the kind of story that one usually only shares in the privacy of a therapist's office with only their ears to hear it, I want to ask you to use me to think about these questions and then look at your story to consider these questions and any other questions that what I'm sharing may spark for you for yourself. What kind of impact would you guess these types of experiences did to my attachment style, to my feelings of security and safety in the world? What do you think that did to my thoughts inside of my head? Do you think it slowed them down? Do you think it sped them up? In today's world, people are very quick to jump to ADD, attention deficit disorders. What do you think this would have done to my attention? And would that be a disorder? Or would that be a very normal response to what was happening? So would the disorder be in me or in the situation? What did my little body learn about life? What did my little body learn to feel through these scary experiences? From those feelings, what thoughts do you think were born in my little consciousness? Positive ones? Scary ones? I was raised with religion. Do you think I had questions for God? What would I learn about life through my limited little kid logic? How I might make sense of something today would be very different than how I could have made sense of it back then. How often are we operating under a subconscious logic that we learned because of something in our childhoods that we just keep operating on because we haven't taken it out and examined it? What would I have learned about falling asleep or going to sleep? Without blaming, what happens to a child's nervous system if and when a parent doesn't know how or doesn't feel inspired to or just won't comfort, soothe, console? Or what if their efforts earnestly just really miss the mark of what another small human being needs? Does my understanding or compassion for my mother, for her own life that resulted in a low empathy human being making decisions for her children, decisions that would ultimately, for me, take me to a place of estrangement. Does my understanding and compassion for her, does that do anything to help me heal now? If it does it help me heal on the psychological plane or on the spiritual plane? Does it do anything for my nervous system? How do I do more than understand my abuser? Or how do I do more than understand my situation in an effort to heal myself? Is understanding enough? Or is there more that I could do? Will I allow myself to understand even my early childhood so that I may learn to provide to myself the words, the comfort, the experiences and practices that reparent me that bring balance to my life, that bring balance to my mind, my heart, my nervous system? What do I deserve from myself now as an adult? What do I deserve from myself in general? What do I deserve from myself in respect of my early childhood experience? What am I willing to do that maybe my parents or my caretakers weren't? How am I willing to love myself beyond the messaging, beyond the mistakes, beyond the vibration of my early childhood? If you think the practice of peace would help you on your journey, I am very proud to be able to offer this course at a very low price point because of this audience I have. When I create content, I very much am creating it so that I can reach as many people as possible. I would rather have a business that meets more people at a lower price point than serves 10 or 20 people at a very high price point. No shade to you if that is your model and you're a coach or a therapist out there. Do your thing. I just like doing it a little differently. Emotional strength training, 30 days to peace, are 30 different, I hope enjoyable, fun, light exercises to help you practice the very peace that may elude you the way it eluded me for so many years. We can't just talk in therapy. We cannot just read books. I wish it were true. I wish it would work that you could just listen to this podcast and it would totally heal you. But I wouldn't be in my integrity if I told you that that stuff would heal you. It's like building muscles. You can't read a book about muscles and look at your muscles and go, why aren't my muscles getting bigger? You have to do the exercises that build the muscles. Peace is a muscle. And if it's been atrophied because of the circumstances of your life, I want you to know exactly which weights and what exercises to do to help you work those peace muscles. Please use code BADASS to save 30%. It makes the course less than $100. 30 days where you hang out with me in the morning for 5 to 15 minutes. Most of the exercises are under 7. And all you have to do is move through an experience. That's all that's required. The next group goes through together starting on the 1st of the month. Come sign up. It's very, very simple. And then you'll just get an email on the 1st and you will start the course. Find Emotional Strength Training 30 Days to Peace at emotionalbadass.com/peace. Here are some comments from past participants. I really needed this today. As a parent of a 2-year-old, fatigue easily triggers a mundane and stressful outlook. I used to look forward to my morning shower and to the newness of the day, but the fatigue and stress of parenting has robbed me of that. I have already showered today, but tomorrow morning I will apply the beginner's mind to my shower to find some joy in it again. I will also apply it to my drive between my 2 jobs. Thanks, Nikki. I'm not getting through this course very quickly. That's okay. But I'm marinating through it, and each lesson seems to be perfect timing for what I'm needing to find. Peace. Thank you so much for that. I want to read another. Feeling unimportant is definitely a trigger for me to feel angry, resentful, and hurt. When others don't want to listen to my ideas, thoughts, and feelings, I will remember I am important and valuable. If others are not in a place to consider what I have to say, that is okay and does not change my value or importance. I love the comments that y'all leave on this course because each one of you takes exactly what you need from each different lesson. Okay, here's another. I've been practicing waiting and trusting that the next opportunity for me will come at the right time and will be the right next step in my life and career. I am using this waiting to heal and work on myself. I do believe there is something good coming, and I will do what I can to make sure I am ready to move forward when the opportunity is available. Trusting in God or the universe to open the right doors and help me do the work in preparation has been difficult, as I am prone to control, overthinking, and anxiety. This exercise was timely and helpful. Sign up for the course today at emotionalbadass.com/peace. Use code BADASS to get your discount. Emotional Badass is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. I am an emotional badass. You are an emotional badass. And together, we are where Moxie meets Mindful. Light and love. Take care of yourselves and your sweet inner child. And I'll see you right here next time for a brand new episode. Bye-bye.
Find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply or